program you are about to hear, Bob's Slacktime Funhouse, is parody, satire, and comedy. Any reference to Bob, the Church of the Subgenius, religion, politics, or any other touchy subjects is intended only as humor and should cast no reflection on the high standards of WREK Atlanta, its staff, or that of Georgia Tech.
As you may or may not know, Pope Robert Anton Wilson recently departed dimension. And so, tonight, in the spirit of celebration and the spirit of slacking off, Bob's Slacktime Funhouse presents an hour of Robert Anton Wilson with various collaborators, interviewers, and co-conspirators. Pope Robert Anton Wilson doing what he does best, assuming that he's still doing this in the next realm.
Passing down a long, heavily carpeted hall, past paintings of the great mathematicians of history, Schrödinger and Pythagoras and Adam Weishaupt and Aleister Crowley, I opened the door and met Chico and Groucho and Harpo.
Now the Vice President, Richard Cheney, has given us another three-valued logic, true, false, and despicable. The true statements are the ones the government makes, the false statements are the ones the enemies abroad make, and the despicable statements are the ones that we're not supposed to think about at all. I'm not sure he thinks he can stop us from thinking about it, but he wants to stop us from talking about it anyway. I heard him on CNN a week or so ago where he was asked about criticisms of the Bush administration. He described them as despicable. Yes is what you can prove, no is what you can disprove, and despicable is what you can't even test. You're not allowed to test it. It's the modern equivalent of the Catholic term heretical. You're not supposed to think about it at all. I'm proud to say this book consists almost 100% of despicable statements. Nobody is supposed to be thinking about these things. I don't believe there should be anything we're not allowed to think about.
My favorite religion is actually Shinran Buddhism. I was married in a Shinran Buddhist church 35 years ago. And the great thing about Shinran is it's an offshoot of Amida Buddhism. Amida was the Buddha who refused to enter Nirvana until all sentient beings could enter Nirvana with him. And so he reincarnates for perpetually to bring everybody to supreme enlightenment. And part of the teaching of Amida Buddhism is if you call on Amida Buddha once with true faith, that'll be enough. Even if you screw up this life entirely, in your next life you'll do better, and the life after that you'll do better until eventually you do achieve total detachment and nirvana. All you gotta do is say in Japanese, Namu Amida Butsu, in the name of Amida Buddha. If you say it with true faith, you will eventually be saved. And in the 12th century, a monk named Shinran meditated on this until his heart broke. He thought it was just not fair to those people who can't muster a true faith. There are some people who are always asking questions, never satisfied, always asking the next question, always a little bit skeptical. I'm one of them. And we just can't manage true faith. We just can't, we're always wondering. Maybe there's an alternative. Maybe there's another way of looking at it. And Amida, the Buddha of boundless compassion, could he possibly leave us out if he intends to bring all beings to perfect bliss and enlightenment? And Shinran decided that was impossible. So Shinran Buddhism is based on the teaching that if you say Namu Amida Butsu once, whether you have faith or not, it's enough. You'll be saved eventually. I think that is the most merciful, the most commonsensical, the most generous, and the most noble religion ever invented. At least it seems that way to those of us who are incapable of true faith in the traditional sense. And so I have said Namu Amida Butsu with some degree of faith and with a great deal of skepticism on numerous occasions. I've never managed total faith, but I like to say it because Shinran says whether I believe it or not, it will work. And so I'd like to leave everybody with those words, Namu Amida Butsu. Say them once, and whether you believe it or not, it will work, and all your problems will be solved. It may take 1,000 incarnations, but eventually you'll get there. And hey, we got lots of time.
Some of your favorite burnt books or heretic material?
Some of my favorite burnt books?
Books that have been burnt in the past or books that have been banned?
Yeah. Well, the first one I think of is The Mass Psychology of Fascism by Wilhelm Reich, which was burned by the United States government in 1957. It had been burned by the Soviet Union earlier and by Nazi Germany even earlier than that. And it describes very accurately the system of government we have now, which I call the TSOG, the Tsarist Occupation Government. And Reich's argument was that fascism is not a, aberration that happened in Italy and Germany for a few decades. It's sort of the permanent undercurrent of all patriarchal authoritarian societies. When they're under threat, they turn fascist. Fascism is just a modern name for something that's been happening periodically throughout the history of authoritarian pyramidal civilizations. Like the Inquisition was the last major breakout of the same spirit. And I think we've got it in this country now in the form of the czarist government that has taken over, which started with Reinhard Gehl. And I don't know how many of you have ever heard of Reinhard Gehl, and he was Hitler's chief of Soviet intelligence. And he had an arrangement with some czarists who had infiltrated the KGB and the Red Army. And they were his sources of information on the Soviet Union, which gave Hitler the idea that he could knock off the Soviet Union in a couple of weeks and then go back to fighting England and France, which turned out to be a little bit inaccurate. But in spite of their bad record in that case, Galen managed to sell them to the United States government at the end of World War II. He was the first of the major intelligence agents to surrender. As a matter of fact, he went looking for the United States Army so he could surrender. And he told them, I was the head of Soviet intelligence for Hitler, and I've planted 3 truckloads of information about the Soviet Union, which I'll be happy to turn over to you if you let me have an American general's uniform and get me out of this Nazi uniform and give me some protection. He ended up being the head of Soviet operations for the CIA, and that was the beginning of the czarist infiltration of our government. His major contact to the Soviet Union was General Vlasov, who believed in mystical czarism, which is the doctrine that, well, it's very complicated, especially the way it was developed by some of the better Russian minds of the 19th century. What it comes down to is reason is cold and inhuman, faith is warm and human, therefore we should be governed by faith, not by reason, and the best faith of all is faith in the Tsar, which made a lot of sense to a lot of intellectual Russians in the 19th century. It made no sense at all to some of the others. It's rejected entirely by Roman Catholics who believe we should put our faith in the Pope and not the Tsar, and by the Moonies who believe we should put our faith in Reverend Moon, and the Scientologists who believe we should put our faith in the ghost of L. Ron Hubbard. But anyway, once we put our faith in the total faith in some human figure who represents divine, who's divinely guided to always tell the truth, then we have an officially divine medicine, an officially divine government, an officially divine hygiene, everything is defined by faith, not by reason. And that's why we got a czar now in Washington decreeing what medicines we can take, what medicines we can't take, what recreations we can enjoy, how much pain we've got to endure when we're dying. That is defined by the czar. Medical evidence, any sort of scientific irrelevance is totally irrelevant because we're all supposed to have faith in the Tsar. And this all started with Reinhard Galen's penetration of American intelligence at the end of World War II, bringing along all these Tsarists with him. And so that's why I wrote the Book of Tsog, the book which I quoted earlier. And the beast said, by their peace shall ye judge them, and by your peace shall you be judged, and all shall be judged by their peace. And in the snow shall their names be written. Is that enough about mystical czarism and the... you want to find out anymore, go to my website and read the article, Zog, the Creature That Ate the Constitution. T-S-O-G.
Everybody's talking about the chocolate biscuits. Everybody's Is patriotism possible with maybe logic?
I don't see how patriotism is a identification with a given gene pool. I think it has decreased over the centuries because most countries are combinations of gene pools. Where you have one gene pool dominating a country, you still have really fanatical patriotism. It's patriotism, it's loyalty to the gene pool. As Haldane said, evolution has programmed us so that we'll die for a brother and risk our life for a cousin. And beyond that, who will risk his life for a stranger? Very few will. Some will, but they're rare. So it's sort of patriotism, gene pool loyalty is sort of built into us. But most countries are combinations of gene pools, most of which don't like each other very much and are in competition or have prejudices against each other. They're economically competing, they're religiously different, and so on. And so patriotism gets more and more attenuated. It only comes to the surface in a really virulent and obnoxious form when everybody feels equally under attack, which is what the terrorists want. They don't mind unifying us as long as we're all unified in the same terror. We're afraid of them. So they don't mind the fact that's bringing us closer together. Besides, it's only bringing us closer together temporarily. In the Revolutionary War, they were black regiments. As soon as the war was over, they were re-enslaved. If you get what I mean. Everybody is united in this country, almost everybody is unified. Right now, they feel unified, but that doesn't end the fact that the rich are mostly white males and the poor are mostly black females. That doesn't change that fact, for instance. What is patriotism? I think it's a ridiculous superstition. But to put the best face on it, it's loyalty to that which you admire most in your own country. Well, what I admire most in our country is the Founding Fathers and the Bill of Rights and the gradual extension of the suffrage so it includes almost everybody. Too bad we don't have candidates to vote for. There's a lot I admire in this country, but it exists elsewhere in the world too, not just in this country. So it's patriotic in the sense that it's very much in favor of the Constitution. Of course, not all of the Constitution. I think it has defects, like the slavery business, for instance. I don't want to restore that. But I just think the Constitution is one of the better political systems devised by humanity, and it's one that has strong roots in this country. And it still exists. You can look in the back of the dictionary, and there it is. It has nothing to do with the way our government actually operates, but it's in print. It's in the back of damn near every dictionary. You can find it in many schoolrooms hanging on the wall. So to the extent that it exists, it's an ideal that people can more or less recognize. If SOG has no other effect than people reread the Constitution and start thinking about it, I'll be satisfied.
Why does faith get such a bad name in SOG?
Well, it requires faith to decide that something is despicable rather than checking it, doesn't it? I think faith is the mental health problem number one on this planet. What's going on right now, the latest crusade, after 1,000 years or more or less after the crusades began, we're in another crusade because people who have faith in Christianity and people who have faith in Islam have an equal and opposite faith that the other people are all wrong. If they don't share our religion, there's something wrong with them. If they have dark skin, that's another thing that's wrong with them. So, and on the other hand, they have the belief if you don't belong to Islam, you're wrong. And if you keep attacking Islam repeatedly over 1,000 years, you're very, very wrong, and we're going to blow the shit out of you. And all of this results from faith. Like Israel, for instance, the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. If they all became atheists overnight, imagine if there was a bolt of thunder and they all suddenly woke up and realized they don't know anything, they're just guessing. They could negotiate an agreement satisfactory to both sides within about 2 weeks. The reason they can't do that at present is because each one of them has a sacred scripture that says you've got a right to fight for this land and God is on your side, so go on fighting and God will take care of you. As long as people have that kind of faith, they're never going to stop fighting and killing each other. Mencken said religion is the chief fomenter of hatred in the history of the world. I would say faith is the chief fomenter of war in the whole history of the world. Even in comparatively secular societies, it becomes an article of faith that the government is justified, the other side is all wrong, we're all right, and nobody's supposed to think about the question at all. That becomes despicable. I believe we should think about the despicable. That which is labeled heretical, despicable, blasphemous, outrageous, those are the things we should think about most. Those are the most important issues confronting us, in my mind.
Let's go!
Studied the Illuminati for years. Have you come to any conclusions about their aims?
Usually when people ask me that question, I give them some kind of a put-on, but I can't think of a good and original put-on that I haven't done several times before, so I'll tell you the truth for once. I think the Illuminati was a short-lived society of free thinkers and democratic reformers that formed a secret society within Freemasonry, using Freemasonry as a cover so they could plot to overthrow all the kings in Europe and the Pope. And I'm very happy that they succeeded in overthrowing all the kings. I wish they had completed the job and got rid of the royal family in England too, but they did pretty well on the continent. And I'm sorry they haven't finished off the Pope yet, but I think they're still working on the project and I wish them luck.
What is your feeling about the fact that the Kansas school boards have denigrated the teaching of Darwin's theories in high schools?
Well, we need a source of cheap labor. The third world doesn't provide all we need. We need people who speak English right away to start with, for some of the menial labor. You have an educational system that is a total, complete joke and a failure. Then that's where we get the people who clean the toilets and mop the and clean up the streets and so on. Kansas is going to provide us with that. I think it's very gallant of them, and I really appreciate their offer. So I'm all for Kansas. Goodness, Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, though.
With something like The X-Files or Art Bell's conspiracy radio show becoming so popular in the American culture, conspiracy theory obviously is being talked about everywhere, and people are not trusting the government or the media or this and that. On the other hand, they believe anything.
Well, I blame that on the churches and the ignorance of the public at large. The major thing you should learn in any decent education is to how to judge and evaluate news sources of information. If I say to you, the people in the next apartment are all zebra-striped and they fly around 3 feet above the ground, how are you going to judge and evaluate that? Well, there are all sorts of one way of, what does it sound plausible to you? In other ways, how honest do you think I am? And there are lots of other ways, but most people have no standards of evaluation at all to judge between something that's plausible, something that's totally impossible, something that's possible but not probable, something that's probable but not yet proven. They don't have those distinctions because any teacher in the United States, and I think in most Christian countries, any teacher who's caught trying to teach children how to judge statements, immediately the whole school board, all the parents, and especially the local clergy come down on his case, and he or she gets fired, thrown out on their ass, has to find work in another field. You can't teach children to think. It's against the law. So, of course, nobody has any standards how to judge whether Martians are in the White House or General Motors owns the president, or whether there are fetuses of extraterrestrials at Fort Bragg. They have no standards by which to judge, so they judge by whoever they heard speak most recently. Oh, that must be the truth. I just heard it 5 minutes ago. They don't have an attention span that goes more than 10 minutes. And that's because they've never been taught how to use their brains. I used to advertise my seminars as how to use your brain for fun and profit. Most people don't even know how to use it for fun, much less than how to use it for profit.
When they changed the $20 bill, a friend of mine remarked that it looked like a coupon, and it made me think how abstract money really is. It's no longer a certificate that you could redeem for its value in silver or in gold. It's just some kind of arbitrary credit that you have in your bank account. Obviously, there's a sort of a belief in the monetary system that keeps it afloat. What would happen if everybody just stopped believing in money?
If everybody went to the bank and took out their money, the whole damn system would collapse, because the banks are allowed by law to loan 8 times as much as they have on deposit. That's considered safe because it's unlikely that everybody will go in and take their money out all at once. Actually, according to Penny Lerno, and a very good book on modern banking called In Banks We Trust, they habitually loan more than 8 times what they've got on deposit, a hell of a lot more than 8 times. When the SEC catches them, they get fined, and the case is not publicized, not just because the bankers own the government, but because if they did publicize it, it might start a run on the banks, and the whole system would fall down like it did in the 1930s. It's very strange, but these pieces of paper that people have so much faith in, if you read them very carefully, they're not promising to give you anything. They used to. When I was young, every dollar bill said only you could redeem it in silver on demand. Now it just says that it's legal tender for all debts, which means you can't exchange it for anything but more paper. If people lost faith in the paper, the whole system would fall apart. Money in the modern world is just pure information. It's as abstract as information in cybernetic theory. Which brings up the question, how come people get to charge interest on distributing information? Ezra Pound said we're living in a usurocracy, that is, a system dominated by usury. And it sure does look that way, especially when you realize that we're paying interest on money that doesn't exist except by some kind of social convention. I often ask in my workshops, I get the whole audience involved, I ask them, what's the difference between a counterfeit dollar bill and a real dollar bill? Eventually it comes down to, we got to have faith that the Federal Reserve has a magic wand, and when they print paper, they pass the magic wand over, it becomes money. When the mafia prints paper in a cellar, they don't have the magic wand, so it's not real money. How does the Federal Reserve get away with this one when nobody ever suspects it?
When he accepted the presidential nomination at the Democratic Convention in 1991, Bill Clinton thanked his mentor at Georgetown University, Professor Carol Quigley. And all around the country, far-right conspiracy researchers saw their jaws drop to the floor. Why was that?
He must have known what he was doing. Sometimes I think Bill Clinton has more of a sense of humor than we realize. He knew that that was going to set off buzzes. For the benefit of those who are not familiar with right-wing conspiracy theory in this country, Carol Quigley is a historian who wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, in which he admitted he had access to the private papers of what he regarded as the biggest conspiracy in the world at his time. He thought it was a benevolent conspiracy, and he wanted to show the world how much good they had done. This was the conspiracy that connected the American Council on Foreign Relations with the British Royal Institute of International Affairs, and it was largely financed by British and American banks, and it's largely staffed the upper positions of the governments of the United States and England since about 1900, more or less, 1914, somewhere around there. And the right wing loves Quigley's book because of the admissions he makes about the power of this group. The funny thing is, one of my favorite conspiracy groups, A.L. Bionic in Ferndale, Michigan, they claim that since Quigley taught at a Jesuit college, that's Georgetown University in Washington, he taught at a Jesuit, he must have been an agent of the Jesuit conspiracy, which is opposed to the conspiracy of these British and American bankers. So his real job was not to just reveal the secrets of the bankers' conspiracy, but to do it in the way that would do the most damage to the bankers. He was actually an agent of the Jesuits. So according to A.L. Bionic, Bill Clinton, in praising Carol Quigley, was not showing his affiliation with the international bankers. He was showing his affiliation with the Jesuits, the Knights of Malta, and the whole Vatican conspiracy. So I think Bill did it because he has a sense of humor. He likes seeing all the conspiracy nuts going off at once.
Ask is that you don't say things as dumb as that guy in the Vatican who recently went to Africa, where the chief problems are starvation and AIDS, and he told them not to use condoms.
Evolution.
butterfly.
Who is God? Well, it's an invisible person and he lives up in heaven.
How much longer do you see Christianity lasting?
I wrote three historical novels in the 1980s, and one of the most disillusioning things I found out was that Voltaire, that paragon of reason and skepticism and caution, Voltaire had a period in which he thought the Catholic Church would be gone in 20 years. That was after they dissolved the Jesuits. Later they allowed the Jesuit order to reform, but when they dissolved the Jesuits, he wrote an ecstatic letter saying, the Catholic Church is falling apart, it will be gone in 20 years. Considering how persistent the Christian virus has been, I don't see any hope of eliminating it in the near future. I just hope for more and more amelioration, like the First Amendment over here and the similar laws in other advanced industrial nations, which prevent the Christians from burning us at the stake, which they would do again. The minute they had the freedom to do it, they would do it, you know. As Nietzsche said, it's not their love for us that keeps them from burning us at the stake anymore. It's the impotence of their love. They don't have the power to burn us at the stake. But if they could save our souls by burning us at the stake, don't you think our souls are worth more than our bodies? They'd burn us at the stake again as soon as they had the right to do it. So as long as we have some protection, that much protection against them, the virus will go on raging indefinitely, I suppose.
Bob, recently, the story that Timothy Leary was an FBI snitch has been reported in the Associated Press, on the BBC, and on the SmokingGun.com website. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
The way I understand it, and I was fairly close to Tim, he tried to persuade the FBI he was giving them valuable information. And the FBI finally decided he wasn't giving them enough valuable information, so they threw him back in the can and he served two more years. This was well known at the time. Everybody was afraid they were going to get busted. I don't know anybody that got busted because of Tim's testimony. He didn't tell the FBI a damn thing that hurt anybody. He was negotiating with them and he didn't get away with it. He lost. The FBI got wise that he wasn't telling them anything important and he served more time. They actually put him there. They gave him the reputation of a snitch, hoping he'd get killed because they wanted to get rid of him. But the important issue to me is not that, but how did he get in prison in the first place? Timothy Leary went to prison to warn other scientists not to do research in that area. The government outlawed research on LSD as a behavior change agent in 1966. They threw Timothy in jail in 1970, so every scientist in the country would know they really meant business. They wanted to close down that area of research, at least public research. The CIA was doing research on that before, and probably they continued it afterwards. But they didn't want the research known to the public, they didn't want it published, and they didn't want it scientifically refereed, because the CIA discovered they could cuff people's heads up real bad with LSD. Timothy discovered the opposite, that with the proper set and setting, you can change almost any behavior pattern that somebody has and wants to get rid of and doesn't know how to get rid of. I think his research tended to indicate, and a lot of other research at the same time before it was all forbidden, that any bad habit, compulsion, neuroses, whatever you want to call it, anything you want to get rid of and you don't know how, you can get rid of quicker using LSD therapy than any other form of therapy. And the government claims they outlawed that to protect us. Now, the government claims to be so eager to protect us, they were submitting soldiers and civilians, too, we recently found out, to radiation experiments, which gave them cancer and other horrible diseases. They were still continuing the Tuskegee project, in which black men with syphilis were exerbed regularly but not treated to find out how the syphilis would spread through their families and their communities and so on. It was treating them like guinea pigs because they weren't white. And this was still going on when they threw Leary in jail. The media never refers to why Leary went to prison. The judge who sentenced him to 37 years said his ideas were dangerous. That's why the Swiss gave him asylum as a political refugee, because he was condemned for his ideas. Nobody in this country, they think he was condemned for dealing drugs. He was condemned actually for being in possession of half a joint, which he claims the cop planted on him. What you think of that depends on whether you trust Timothy Leary more than you trust an Orange County cop, or you trust an Orange County cop more than you trust Timothy Leary. I personally, in that case, don't think Timothy Leary was dumb enough to go to Orange County with a joint in his pocket. I think the cop did plant it on him. But whatever you think, 37 years is abnormal at a time when the penalty for possessing a half a joint was 6 months. And when they set his bail at $5 million higher than they've ever set on any murderer in American history, I think it's pretty obvious the Swiss were right. He was being persecuted politically for spreading ideas the government didn't like. This is a civil liberties issue that people should be concerned about, because it doesn't just involve Timothy Leary. It involves thousands of scientists who know about that research and would like to replicate it. And sometimes they do replicate it, but they only spread the results by word of mouth with their friends. They're afraid to publish it. This is the worst violation of scientific freedom since the Holy Inquisition, and nobody in the mass media will admit there's an issue there at all. They can't see it, they won't see it, and they won't let anybody talk about it. It's amazing.
Why is Aleister Crowley still important?
Crowley was the first writer of so-called New Age or mystical or occult tendency that I ever took seriously. Well, I took him seriously because he had such a great sense of humor. I figured somebody this funny must have something, he must be saying something behind all these jokes. So I started studying him, and I found he did have a lot important to say, and I value him highly. I think relativity is one of the most important ideas of the 20th century. Einstein gave us physical relativity. Joyce gave us artistic relativity by telling Ulysses in 100 different narrative voices instead of just the one allegedly objective, detached observer of 19th century fiction. And Crowley did the same thing for the mystical occult world with his law of Thelema, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, which fills every moron in the world with terror, anxiety, paranoia, and general discombobulation. It's okay to say, do what I will shall be the whole of the law. Every religious teacher in history has said that. Nobody mind. Yes, yes, tell us what to do. Tell us what to do. Yes, master, when we kiss your feet, master. But if you say, do what thou wilt, what, you're giving me the responsibility? I can't take on that responsibility. You tell me what to do. I think people who were looking for... I've defined a disciple as an orphan looking for a human being to attach itself to. The Crowley system does not have any disciples. It doesn't tell you what to do. It tells you to decide for yourself what to do. I think it's the most libertarian philosophy to ever arise out of the mystical, whatever it is, the mystical mishmash.
What is the 23 Enigma?
Well, the 23 Enigma, did I start to sound a little like Burroughs then? I thought I did. Well, the 23 Enigma. Burroughs told me about the 23 Enigma back around 65. He had observed a lot of coincidences connected with the number 23. And as soon as he told me that, I started noticing coincidences involving the number 23. I put a lot of them into the Illuminati novels, and I put a bunch of them into the first of my Cosmic Trigger trilogy. And ever since then, I've been getting letters from people who've observed odd 23s, and there's no end to it. I'll tell you a very amusing anecdote. I was in St. Louis giving a lecture, and a guy came up after the lecture with his wife and said, I figured out how your 23 gimmick works. And I said, oh, tell me. And he said, it's a neurological grid. You make your readers very conscious of 23, more conscious than they are of the other numbers. And I said, congratulations, you found the great magician who makes the grass green. That's a sign of enlightenment in Zen. Which I thought was an adequate answer. Then a little while later, it turned out we went out to have a pizza together, he and his wife and me. And one of those places where you get a number while you wait for your pizza. And of course, we got number 23. And he said to me, how do you do it? And I said, I thought you did it that time. And I suppose he's still wondering about that. Well, so am I. It just happens, that's all. It's the enigma. Why does it keep happening? A neurological grid is part of it, but that's not all of it.
If you were elected president, what's the first thing you would do?
Resign.
The dog, the tree, the cat, the tree. Where is the tree for you and me? Turn it upside down, the whole world upside down. Down. Dog of the
I sent him my car to pick you up. And Marilyn Monroe said, oh, you have a car? And Chico said, no, I used to have a car and a chauffeur, but I couldn't afford both, so I get rid of the car. And she said, well, what good is a chauffeur without a car? He said, I need him to drive me to work. She said, well, how can you go to work without a car? He said, it's all right, I've been made redundant.
Well, since 9/11, war seems to be the route that much of the world is taking. Are you discouraged by this?
Well, in the short run, anybody who isn't pessimistic is has got to be stoned out of their gourd, I think. As long as the United States has these foreign policies that irritate three-quarters of the planet, we're going to have terrorists. We get rid of, somehow or other, the United States succeeds in getting rid of Osama bin Laden, and somehow or other manages to wipe out Al-Qaeda entirely, and cripples Islam in some way that it's not going to give birth to another Al-Qaeda, all of which seems very improbable to you. If they accomplish all that, as Bush says, this war has no end because there'll be terrorists from other third world countries who'll be pissed off at us still. Until the United States gives up trying to bully the whole world, there's going to be terrorists trying to get out from under being bullied. So there's no end to this war. It's like the war on drugs, you know, no end in sight. The funding goes on forever. And the party never ends. The funding goes on forever and the party never ends. That's a paraphrase of a country and western song. I think my writing comes out of anger and optimism. Anger at the stupid, maniacal, or corrupt crowd that's running the world at present, and optimistic about the opportunities that are so real. Why don't science and technology create a real possibility of what used to be called utopia. Any utopian fantasy anybody ever imagined, we are on the edge of achieving it if we use our energy and our technology intelligently. But unfortunately, the people who own the technology are not using it intelligently, so that makes for anger. So I got both optimism and anger, which I think is a good mixture. It keeps me busy anyway. Yes, I've caught with something particularly nasty about George Bush. I may feel good for 2 or 3 hours afterwards, if it's funny enough, and I think it might get widely quoted, or at least limited quotation. Colin Wilson, who I met a few times, we're not related despite the same last names, he told me the difference between writers and serial killers is that writers have another outlet for their rage. And that was back in the 1980s, he told me that, long before I discovered Hannibal Lecter. And I looked at the Hannibal Lecter films and I realized, I kind of like this guy. I wouldn't do anything like that. I'm too gentle and I have too much empathy and so on. But I really would like to devour a couple of hundred congressmen and a few dozen televangelists if I had the nerve to do it. Those people seem like such monsters to me. I wish Hannibal did eat a few of them. I can't do it myself, so I let him do it for me. But meanwhile, I got my writing as an outlet. But boy, Jerry Falwell and Strom Thurmond and George Bush and, oh, there's quite a few of them that I think would make excellent gourmet treats for Dr. Lecter if he was still around. Last heard of, he was in Buenos Aires, you know.
If you would like more information on the Church of the Subgenius, you could write to them at P.O. Box 181-417, Cleveland Heights, Ohio, 44118-1417, or visit them online at subgenius.com.
Every Saturday night at midnight on WREK, the Hour of Slack oozes with culture and civility. Unlike those troglodytic nincompoops at Bob Slack Time Funhouse, the Hour of Slack brings high culture to the discerning Yeti. Also, I hear that listening to Bob Slack Time Funhouse will violate your parole. That's the Hour of Slack, every Saturday night at midnight here on WREK Atlanta.
According to some scholars, the inner ear is not only the locus of balance and normal attunement, it is the station where extra audio psi signals are received. So, it's no wonder J.R. Bob Dogs would seek out the most arcane secrets of radio technology and learn what effects they would have on normal, abnormal, and subgenius inner ears and brains. Bob Dogs understood, long before the televangelists, that conversion of the masses could be vastly simpler with today's mind control technology. So, he set out to speak deep into the human brain itself. This is why the Hour of Slack is not just radio. The Hour of Slack is the direct product of a scientific and mystical experiment. The mission of the Hour of Slack is stacking extra audio information in the listener's inner ear so it's never forgotten. That's the Hour of Slack, every Saturday night at midnight, right here on WREK Atlanta.
Every Saturday night at 1 a.m. on WREK, Bob Slack Time Funhouse provides a fresh infusion of sophisticated slack for the modern Yeti. Unlike the Hour of Slack, Bob's Slacktime Funhouse does not contain subliminal CIA programming. I knew this one guy who listened to the Hour of Slack and tried to peel himself like an orange. That's Bob's Slacktime Funhouse here on WREK Atlanta.